When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition comic book podcast, where we discuss the famous, infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, Brian Reese.
Hey, here I am. And here we both
are. Yes, here we both are.
Here we are now. Entertain us.
So we haven't recorded in a few weeks. So this is probably old news at this point. But Jonathan Hickman will be leaving the X-Men series after he retooled and streamlined the X-Men into this nice, tight, coherent storyline that eventually blew up and became unruly. An unruly behemoth.
That was a joke.
Yes. Well, no, he did. He made it nice and streamlined, and he whittled it down to just a few titles. But the X-Men being X-Men, it has become this.
Marvel being Marvel.
Yes. It has massively gone crazy because we can't have nice things.
Well, yeah. And thank goodness that DC shows restraint and keeps its back titles to just a couple.
Oh, yeah. Just a couple dozen. Yeah. You haven't been reading the X-Men Hickman run.
Not a single word.
That's too bad because it actually was really good. I was skeptical at first, but you know, Hickman being Hickman, he knows how to organize things. And he always has his little charts.
Got charts and graphs. Yeah,
his charts and graphs and neat things. And he acted as sort of a, I know what you call him, like a showrunner for the franchise. You know, he kept everything in order. And even when new titles were coming in and new authors came on, new writers, I should say, you know, he kept things manageable.
Yes.
For a time.
Well, and you know, Hickman is well known for being good at starting things.
Yes. Hey, he did an admirable job as far as Marvel's concerned of doing the, you know, the Secret Wars crossover and whittling everything down into one universe, you know, just making it nice and tight. And then
like Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Yeah. And then he went away, as he does. And we'll do again. Now, I like Jonathan Hickman. I think he's really good at what he does. He's really good at organizing.
I'm a big fan of Hickman, particularly his Image stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. But as far as, like, you know, Marvel DC and the superhero things, he's really good at just organizing and getting everything in place. I mean, his runs on Fantastic Four were awesome. Avengers were really good. I you know, I have a lot of praise for Hickman.
Yeah.
And he rebooted the X-Men into something I actually wanted to read again.
Right. This is when Marvel was also allowed to actually acknowledge the existence of the X-Men again, instead of the Inhumans taking over for the X-Men, as was.
Yeah, that was a poor editorial choice. That was, you know, the Inhumans are just a strange and not interesting concept, much like the Eternals, which we'll get into later. Oh, by the way, I haven't said that. We're going to be talking about Neil Gaiman's Eternals, Neil Gaiman and John Romita Jr.'s run on the Eternals from 2006. That's what we're going to talk about when we actually get to talking about it. I have to praise Hickman. He created a storyline that it's complicated in that Hickman way, but right. He literally maps everything out so that you can follow along.
Is this like Captain Kangaroo's picture pages?
Yeah. Well, you know, he does that, you know, looks like the Kabbalah with little circles and lines. He's very good. But he's leaving, which means that the X-Men will spiral.
And where is he going, Paul?
I think he's going to just email newsletters right now.
Yeah.
I keep wanting to call it StubHub, and that's not what it's called. StubHub, that's the ticket.
Substub.
Substack. See last episode for that. We talked about it. Hickman's gone away, and it got me thinking. There have been, and especially since we're going to be talking about Neil Gaiman and his efforts with this comic we're going to be talking about today, There have been writers over the years that have taken franchises that have sort of lost its way, kind of retooled them and rebooted them into something that made them better and more viable.
Reboot isn't necessarily apt in all cases.
Yeah, well, retooling.
Retooling or refreshing.
Refreshing, like a Mountain Dew on a hot day.
Ugh.
I know. So we've each come up with some ideas of examples of retooled series by particular authors that have, taken some things that maybe have gotten a little tired and made them accessible to a more modern audience. So my first example of this, something we've covered on the show, which is Brubaker's Captain America.
Oh, interesting.
when he took over, Captain America was sort of a, it was kind of all over the place.
It was kind of moribund, you know, it was just kind of, it existed.
Yeah. When the 2000s were happening, you know, was this a viable franchise? Was this a viable character that was going to continue? What could be done to make this, what essentially started as a jingoistic propaganda tool, had it run its course? And Brubaker proved, no, it had not. Listen to our episode on Captain America. Give us an example, Brian.
Oh, you're putting this on me. Unsurprising to anybody listening. I mean, I got to go with Grant, right? I got to go with Grant Morrison from Animal Man, Doom Patrol, Batman, X-Men. You know, the multiversity, the multiverse. I just, you know, there are few writers, and I understand that we're talking recent comic book history. There are few writers out there who I think have taken kind of a staid franchise and injected life into it in a way that made it completely fresh and new. Now, I understand that a lot of what Grant Morrison has done has been jettisoned after he did it, because some of the ideas are a little too complex for, you know, the comics gators or the fanboys.
I love the fact that DC constantly has, you know, a Crisis on Infinite Whatevers to kind of whittle everything down into one universe. And then Grant Morrison comes in and goes, hey, how about a multiverse? And then he blows it up again.
Right. But I mean, this cat, just, you give him a franchise and he continually comes up with some crazy, interesting ideas. We were talking about Hickman and the X-Men. You know when the last time I read the X-Men was?
Morrison?
That's bad grammar, by the way. But yeah, it was Morrison. It was Morrison's run on X-Men. And it was, I was kind of like, okay, well, maybe I'll get back into the X-Men. Maybe I'll keep reading. And then immediately, like after he leaves, they just change everything back.
You know, he's problematic at this point, but Joss Whedon's run on the X-Men was actually quite good. But I get your point. The X-Men, yeah, just has a tendency to get out of control. What can you say about Morrison? I had forgotten. I was thinking I have Morrison on my list of things as well. And I had forgotten Batman. My goodness.
I agree. There are people who strongly disagree about his run on Batman. And that's fair. Everybody has their take on, you know, where, how they want their characters to be shown.
Well, that's why there's 24 titles for Batman, so everyone can have their own Batman.
And then some writers can, who are still writing Batman, can still go on their Substack newsletters and bitch and moan about their experience writing the biggest franchise in comics.
But you're not bitter.
I like Tiny, and I do, you know, but at some point it's just like airing your dirty laundry like that. It gets a little, it's, you know, he was handed a gift. You know, I'm not here to defend the big two and their editorial decisions, but at some point it's just like, you know, come on, dude, you got paid a lot of money to write the signature franchise in comics. And then you're just going to complain about editorial. Anyway,
Morrison.
You had something to say?
Well, I was going to say, I mean, even Morrison, I mean, I know this is very, a lot of people didn't like this run, but I kind of enjoyed his New 52 Superman take as well. It's not the best Superman I've ever read, but it's definitely interesting.
I think it felt disappointing to folks because they thought they were going to get the you know, a continuation of the best Superman story ever written.
That's not how Morrison rolls.
No, but you know, we weren't going to get All-Star Superman again, and you know, it's so.
No, he was going to try something different and, you know, see if it worked. I think it did. It has flaws, but I, like I said, I find it really, really interesting.
Yeah. Now, as a transition to something, someone you mentioned off camera that you might want to talk about is one of Grant Morrison's, I think, not great reboots was the immensely pretty and beautiful to look at, but completely incomprehensible Green Lantern reboot.
I ended up dropping that. So I know you continued to read it. Yeah, I read the first few issues, and then for various reasons, not that I wasn't enjoying it, it was just sort of like I had too much other stuff going on at the time. I needed to streamline my comic book reading, and that just ended up being one of the casualties.
Well, and trying to read it, as I do, I still read things monthly. At some point, I'll go back and revisit in trade. But
that's kind of where I was at. I was like, this is, that's what, that was led to my, one of my decisions of dropping it was like, okay, I can see this as a whole being something great. Month to month, I kept having to go back and say, wait, now who is this guy and what's their motivation? And
that said, Liam Sharp is doing some of the finest work in his career on that comic. So I don't want to completely diss that comic. It's a phenomenally beautiful comic to look at. But we're getting off topic a little bit.
I think this topic was just something that we could, you know, riff for a little while on.
Which we do. But to transition, I think talking about a Green Lantern reboot, I think you had a Green Lantern reboot in mind.
Yes, and it was Geoff Johns did a reboot of Green Lantern. Not a reboot. Yeah. Actually, I would say a reboot because he brought
back. It was close to a reboot. We could argue semantics and, you know.
Probably going to have a lot of people bemoaning this, but I find Green Lantern to be sort of meh, not one of my favorites. When done well, it can be great, but it's rarely done well, in my opinion. I know there's a lot of people who love Green Lantern, and I'm sorry. I personally just don't really enjoy those comics. But Geoff Johns made it really interesting, and he made characters dynamic and compelling, which I hadn't seen in a long time.
Well, and I think running concurrently to that was also Dave Gibbons' Green Lantern Corps, which I enjoyed immensely. You know, it was nice to have a comic that focused not just on Green Lantern, but the Green Lantern Corps, because I think there's a lot of really interesting story. I mean, they're space police. Come on, how fun is that? Space police.
It actually is fun. I think it was done better in Toy Story, but...
but it was, you know, besides the fact that it's Dave Gibbons who has, you know, a slightly important pedigree elsewhere as well.
He's someone to watch, man.
Yeah. that was an interesting time for Green Lantern. And I was reading obsessively the Green Lantern comics at the time, both of them. And, you know, I thought... I think it at some point it got a little too colorful. I think it was very interesting because it was Geoff Johns taking Green Lantern and throwing him into space and forgetting any kind of Earth stuff, right? You know, it's not Green Lantern zipping around on Earth doing stuff. He took Green Lantern and completely made it a space opera, as opposed to the mix that we have often had with Green Lantern, where
I think that's where he belongs. Like, making it a space opera is so much more compelling than just being on Earth and, you know, oh, I'm going to catch you in a giant baceball glove. I think it works well for the character to be the spacefaring space police, which is great. Speaking of spacefaring space police, brings me to another example of a fantastic reboot, I think, which was Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning's version of Guardians of the Galaxy.
Oh, interesting.
Because Guardians of the Galaxy was a very strange comic from the 1970s, which Abnett and Lanning were able to, basically what we see in the movies, that he created a new team using old characters but retooling them. Yeah, it became this really exciting, compelling, again, space opera. And it was very cool. Yeah, good stuff. So you have not obviously read any of that.
Nope.
Yeah.
But that's okay.
Yeah.
You know.
They brought the cosmic Marvel universe back.
Yeah. It's something that Abnett and Lanning have done well. They do space stuff pretty well. Well, I say do, did. I know that they're not working together anymore. I don't know the details of that, but it seemed like a very I'm sure there's some gossip site out there that has the full details, but when they were working together in creating, you know, working in franchises and whatnot, they did a pretty good job with the space stuff. We're doing a lot of space stuff, apparently.
Well, would you like to bring it down a little bit?
Let's speed things up. I would say Mark Waid.
Yes.
On Flash.
Mark Waid on pretty much everything. He's sort of the go-to guy to, you know, when a particular franchise is failing or needs a little kick in the butt, you throw Mark Waid in there.
Right.
He did that with Daredevil. He did that with Black Widow. He did that with Captain America.
With Daredevil, Daredevil's tricky, actually, because I think there's really been kind of one really bad run in recent history. It was the Shadowlands.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, that's what Mark Waid was sent in to rescue it. But I don't really view Mark Waid's run on Daredevil as a reboot, because there had been so many great runs by so many great writers on that comic.
And, well, but he came in to just, no, he didn't reboot it, but he came in to just kind of give it some stability.
Right.
And you know, put it back on track. Yeah. And then let others take over. Because him and Samnee did a great job, I think. I really enjoyed their run.
I did as well. I mean, but also Daredevil's as well established as one of my favorite
characters, yes.
Period, in all of comics. So yeah, but Mark Waid, you know who, I'm going to throw a name out here, and this will cause, I think, reaction. Bendis on Avengers.
On Avengers? Really?
Yeah. Love or hate Bendis's run on Avengers, and there are many opinions on the matter, and mine aren't always positive, but for a long time the Avengers were kind of, they were, X-Men was the comic, right? Marvel's shining jewel. And Avengers hadn't really had great runs for a long time. There were really good writers writing Avengers. I mean, Kurt Busiek, who's one of my favorite writers, did a whole run on Avengers, but they weren't Marvel Prime.
I can see where you're coming from. I remember.
I'm not speaking quality.
Okay. He did. You know what? You're absolutely right. He did bring it back to.
But it was Bendis, because then the Avengers became the Marvel franchise for a long time.
That is true.
And all events, all major happenings ran from the Avengers. And that was Bendis, again, for good or for ill, and people have a lot of feelings on the matter.
Yeah, I mean, I look at that run, and it's basically just the same character talking. He didn't differentiate. His team was just sort of all Bendis's voice.
I'm not talking about the quality.
That's true. But yeah, I can see how he did bring it back to prominence. And I'm not a Bendis hater. I like Bendis quite a bit. I just think he's better on solo books than he is on team books.
Team, right.
Yeah. But you're right. He did give the Avengers a kick in the butt, which is what we're kind of talking about.
A major one.
Well, how about John Byrne's Man of Steel?
That is a thing that exists.
To our premise here, he did reboot to a certain extent the Superman world after the Crisis on Infinite Earths, and was pretty successful at making it popular again.
Right, his Man of Steel it changed Superman for a long time.
Yeah. Ooh, I love the tone of your voice right there. You do not like John Byrne's Man of Steel. I'm kind of indifferent on it, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
It is a thing that happened. And
it was a major, in the same way that Bendis's run on Avengers is a thing that happened. And the world will never be the same again.
Things that are being put out there. The John Byrne run, it has its flaws, for sure. It has some good things to it. John Byrne himself has some flaws. But you have to admit, he did turn around the Superman franchise from something that was kind of people were losing interest in, and brought it back to being a popular title again.
And that's the thing. Sometimes breathing new life, or, you know, we're talking about reboots and refreshes and or whatever the heck we want to call it.
Yeah.
But sometimes the point is stimulating new interest. The end results, like at the time, maybe we're like, oh, this is really exciting, this is really interesting. In retrospect, some of these work, some of these don't work. Again, you know, my favorite writer, Grant Morrison, I don't know if the Green Lantern worked. But, you know, the idea is that when you are trying to jumpstart a franchise that has kind of fallen on hard times for whatever reasons, you know, it's the end result. In retrospect, does it work? In some cases, no. Did it work at the time? Did it create interest? And I think that's kind of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
There are a ton, and I'm sure our thousands of listeners have their own opinions on different writers or artists who have given a fresh start to a character or a comic book franchise. For good or for ill, if it generated interest, that doesn't hurt.
Absolutely. And if you want to talk about someone who took not necessarily titles, but concepts and characters, you have to mention Gail Simone, who with Secret Six and Birds of Prey took, you know, various characters and put them all together. And Batgirl, Wonder Woman.
Basically, everything Gail Simone touches is gold.
Yes, absolutely.
We are a Gail Simone Appreciation Society here. We will brook no disagreement.
Yes, we are Simoneites. But the final person I want to talk to before we move on is, of course, Neil Gaiman, who, much like Grant Morrison, loves to just go in and retool old ideas. Something we've covered on the show, which is Books of Magic, where he basically took all of DC's magical creatures and people and gave everyone a fresh look at them. The Sandman, of course. What can you say about Sandman? He took an old concept, threw it out the window, and created something monumental.
Well, he also, with Sandman, it was basically a new creation.
Yeah, I know. But he was hired to do, hey, can we retool this old character? And he said, yeah, we could totally retool it by not doing it at all and doing this new thing.
Because he owns those characters.
Yeah, that's true.
Along with the, you know, and he signed a better contract than another dude.
We're not going to talk about that anymore. But the segue I was trying to get into is he took, Gaiman that is, he took a concept that many, many people have tried to get to work in the Marvel Universe, which is the Eternals. He gave it his best effort to make it work. And we're going to talk about that right after the break.
Boom! And we're back. Paul, we are discussing your recommendation this week, and I believe, if I remember correctly, you recommended Neil Gaiman's run on The Eternals. Would you like to tell us about it?
In 1970, Jack Kirby and Marvel had what is one of the more infamous breakups in comic book history. This led to Kirby moving to rival DC, who was very willing to give him carte blanche with whatever wacky thing came into his mind. Thus, he created things like the convoluted mythology that is Fourth World. Upon returning to Marvel 5 years later, a now conciliatory Marvel allowed Kirby to continue to indulge his more, let's say, out there ideas. And this led to Kirby utilizing one of his then current interests, ancient aliens. The theory that all of human history and achievement was guided by a race of alien benefactors, popularized by such paragons of scholarship as the Chariots of the Gods, by Eric von Daniken. And so, using the ancient aliens motif as a jumping-off point, Kirby sat down at his drawing board, picked up his pen, and said, "You think Fourth World was convoluted? You ain't seen nothing yet." And lo, the Eternals was born. The original run of the Eternals ran for 19 issues, and it is... Look, the art is amazing. Seriously, it's beautiful and wondrous to look at, but the writing is a little clunky. That being said, no one could ever accuse Jack Kirby of not having ideas, and there are a lot of ideas in the Eternals. Okay, quick version. A race of space giants called the Celestials come to Earth and create three races, humans, deviants, and Eternals. The humans are us, obviously. The deviants are bad guys because they're ugly. There's a lot to unpack there, and I'm not getting into it. And the Eternals are beautiful super beings that can't die. Again, a lot to unpack. Over the millennia, the doings of the Eternals eventually become the basis for all mythology. For instance, Makari, a speedster, became the inspiration for Mercury. Athena, the warrior, became Athena. Zuras, the leader, became Zeus, etc., etc. The Eternals' job is to fight the Deviants until the return of the Celestials, when the Earth will be judged either worthy or not, and either be allowed to continue existing or be destroyed. That is, as I said, the quick version. There is so, so much more to this backstory. Again, to reiterate, Kirby had ideas. Even though Kirby initially envisioned the Eternals as a standalone series, Marvel editorial did not feel the same way. And so many creators over the following decades attempted with limited success to fit the Eternal square into the Marvel round hole. Skip ahead to 2006, and the task fell to a fairly well-known writer, Neil Gaiman, a writer that was quite familiar with taking old concepts and characters and giving them a new spin for a modern audience and propelling them into the public consciousness. And with the Eternals, he really, really tried to do that. Gaiman's story has the Eternals scattered with no memory of who they are or their powers. The 7-issue miniseries is written as an unfolding mystery as the various characters slowly come to remember who they are and unlock their abilities. as well as piece together why they lost their memory in the first place and who was behind it. This serves as a way to reintroduce the characters and concepts to an audience unfamiliar with the Eternals, while at the same time streamlining the ideas as to provide a starting point to an ongoing series. And in this sense, Gaiman does a wonderful job. He deftly handles the reboot aspect to perfection, aided, of course, by the art of John Romita Jr., who does a great job of adapting Kirby's style and designs, but giving them a fresh update for the 2000s. In the end, however, there is something lacking. In spite of all the hard work put in by a powerhouse creative team, the Eternals are missing a spark. And, as with Kirby's original run, there are wonderful moments and an abundance of ideas, but just missing an excitement to pull them all together. Even the great Neil Gaiman and John Romita Jr., it seems, cannot make the Eternals interesting. Brian, what did you think of The Eternals by Neil Gaiman?
Well, I think your introduction was pretty spot on. You know, I have a lot of thoughts on this. There's parts of this comic that are, like you said, a lot of fun. There are parts of it that I feel like Gaiman is retreading some of this. I love Neil Gaiman, but Gaiman has certain themes, and those themes tend to bleed into everything he writes. He just happens to write it better than everybody else.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, there's parts of this comic that are really fun. You know, I mean, it's big, it's cosmic, it has ideas. I actually might have a quibble right at the bat with the John Romita Jr. artwork.
Okay.
I love John Romita Jr. in the 80s.
In the 80s.
But everything, like, so I'm reading this comic, this is 2006, right? Everybody looks like they had the same fashion designer from 1988, 89.
Yeah.
I'm not a fashion maven by any stretch of the imagination, but all Romita's characters all look the same.
You mean as far as facial design? You know.
Facial design, their appearance. His style, which I think was interesting at a certain time, he hasn't altered his style at all. And I just, like, visually, I really felt like I'm reading his and Innocenti's Daredevil run.
You know, I can see exactly what you're saying. You know, Kirby could be accused of doing the same thing.
Right.
All his women look exactly like Sue Storm.
Yeah.
Except some of them are blonde and some are brunettes. But I was thinking more along the lines of, you know, the way he draws the landscapes and the celestials and the superhero stuff is what stands out to me. I can see how, you know, some of the characters kind of do look facially, structurally similar in many ways.
And yeah. I mean, that's not just necessarily a critique to this. I mean, he's done some recent work where I'm reading it and I was like, oh, 1980, you know, even in like stuff he's done over the past year or so. I don't mean to hate on John Romita Jr.
Well, in your same criticism you had of Gaiman, who, you know, Romita Jr. has certain themes in his artistic style.
Yes.
That he likes to, you know, hey, if you know what you're good at, stick with it, I guess.
Yes.
I like the art in this myself, especially, like I said, like, you know, the Celestials look awesome. Can we both agree Celestials are cool? Even if the backstory is convoluted as hell, the actual Celestials, the way they look, they're really cool.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it's they're giant 1,000 foot tall space beings that
there's
around the universe creating things.
Okay. The actual overall story here, I'm kind of torn on. Because I understand what Gaiman's doing. Gaiman is trying to get these characters, get these concepts, and retool them and reboot them for a 2000s audience. And his concept is spot on. Have them all lose their memory and then slowly come to realize who they are and what they're about. And so we get to learn who they are and their backstory as they do. And it's a great concept. It's a, you know, it's really, it's a good idea.
Yeah, it's not tremendously original, but yes.
The problem is that it's just issue after issue. If this had gone a little bit faster, but it's basically 7 issues of these people trying to figure out who they are.
It's one of my major story beats is it's all about awakenings.
Right.
It's a long time coming.
There's a lot of, I don't want to say padding. God, there's stretches of just, this is really boring. Can we just move on, please?
How many times does Cersei have to like have an emo conversation with Tony Stark?
Plus the fact that We'll get into the Marvel characters.
Well, yeah, the Gaiman was saddled with something that I don't think is fair for him to have been saddled with, but we'll get to that. Yeah.
Yeah. But you have Tony Stark saying, "Cersei, you were an Avenger." She's like, "I was never an Avenger." Like, dude, really? You don't need that as part of the story. Yeah. Yes, we know that Cersei as a character was in the Avengers. Like I said in the introduction, trying to get the Eternals to work in the Marvel universe has been a task for a long time. And people like, I don't know, Walter Simonson, they had valiant efforts to make it fit, you know, with the backstory and how, and this is all Kirby, by the way. Mm-hmm. Not only are there Celestials and Eternals and Deviants, but there's also the Kree creating the Inhumans, and then there's Titans. All Kirby just threw everything, all these origin stories, and then left it to other creators to go, but how does that work together? I love Kirby, but he really didn't give a crap about, hey, this is just a good idea, let's just do it. The Eternals, so hard to fit them into established continuity in the Marvel universe. And when you do, it's just so clunky. And that gets to what we were talking about with Cersei.
Well, and it's also like creation myths. And Marvel has several different creation myths.
Because you have, you know, you have the Norse gods and then you have the Greek gods. There are Greek gods in the Marvel universe, but also the Eternals were supposed to be the inspiration behind the Greek gods. And that doesn't jive, man.
Well, and things get even more confusing if you read the X books, the Paradise or the Earth X, Universe X, Paradise X.
Yeah, exactly.
Which tries to fold all this stuff in as well. And it just, again, that's I mentioned Busiek earlier, and you know, but it's that gets kind of wackadoodle too.
Yeah, there's also an attempt to fit the Eternals in with Apocalypse, because right. Apocalypse created stuff too. Yeah.
And where does Thanos fit in all of this?
Well, Thanos is a Titan, and the Titans are Eternals that left Earth. This is, I mean, people have tried really hard to make this work.
Yeah.
And Thanos is actually a deviant, which, man.
Because they're trying to, like, not to get contemporary, but, you know, they're really the current run on Eternals, also done by a writer of some incredible note.
Yes, indeed.
Who also shares themes with Neil Gaiman in their writing. They're trying to fold Thanos back into the whole Eternals.
It remains to be seen. We're recording this before the Eternals movie comes out. I remember when that movie was announced, my first reaction was, really? Eternals? Okay. That was the first. I mean, every time a Marvel movie is announced, I'm like, oh, that's so exciting. This one was, okay. Now, Chloe Zhao is going to be directing it, so that might be very, very interesting.
The cast is
of course stunning. I kind of feel that the movie is actually going to be based a lot on this. We'll see. But let's not talk about the movie. Let's just focus on this comic, which is aggressively mediocre.
that's very generous.
I actually love Neil Gaiman's work, and you can tell when someone's trying their damnedest to make something work. And I'll give him full credit. He is trying.
But it was kind of his idea, too. Like,
no, it was.
Back matter. But I think he got caught up a little bit in... There is an editorial hand moving over this that I think maybe stymies him a bit.
Now, of course, at the time of this writing and release, there was this Civil War crossover. And the, you know, the whole idea of registering superheroes, and that pops rears its head occasionally throughout this story.
Right. It's like every time Tony Stark comes up, he's trying to shows up, and he shows up a lot in this. There's a lot of Tony Stark in this, and every time he shows up, he's trying to get them to register. You know, it's like every damn time.
And I love the fact they're like, well, we're really not superheroes. Okay, you're trying to get off on a technicality. I think it's the slow pace of this.
It's intensely slow.
Yeah, it's relentlessly slow. And I get what he's trying to do. You know, this whole figuring out who they are should have been resolved by issue 3 at the latest.
Or earlier, yeah. And instead, it basically stretches the first 6 issues until we get to the 7th issue, which is a lot of navel gazing. Well, I mean, there's a lot of navel gazing in general. But even the denouement is kind of disappointing.
When it finally gets to the big conclusion and the reveal of the sleeping celestial, which is cool looking.
Right, yeah.
But he's awake. He's going to destroy the Earth. Actually, he's just going to stand there for about an eon or so.
Or however long, silently judging.
Yeah, it's this build-up to this world-destroying creature who does nothing. And it's not even like they talk him down or anything. It just nothing
There's
happens.
There's a point where Icarus, or Icarus, depending on how you want to, is like, well, I'm just going to go talk to him.
And then, of course, you get Ajax. He shows up and just says, hey, you going to go talk to him? I was going to. Well, don't. Okay. Well, that was really intense right there.
The Celestial ends up talking to Makari.
Yeah, I guess we should get into. So
should we start with a brief overview? I mean, I'm sure, you know.
A brief overview of the story. Well, it begins with Icarus reawakening to his old memories. And he becomes sort of he's the de facto leader he's the Orion of the group. he's sort of like the big strong, he's Superman but dumb. He starts to reawaken to his old memories and who he is. And how do you say, like, he's attacked by deviants in disguise, which is the new Transformer toy. Yeah,
there's actually a Transformer reference in this comic.
And so he gets injured and gets sent to a hospital, which happens to have Makari.
Icarus is Icarus.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Kirby was not subtle in his. Athena is Athena. Makari, Mercury. And then Mark Curry is. Okay. Total aside. I did this one night. All right. You ready?
I'm ready.
The Eternals are lost and you know they can't remember. Sprite's a little boy, gotta be one forever. We need a fast guy, gotta activate the sleeper. Hey, Mark Curry.
Wow. Did you have some gummies?
I did not. Unfortunately, that's what I think of. on my own sober mind. So anyway, Icarus.
You have to leave that in.
Maybe. We'll see. So Mark Curry is a nurse. He's not a doctor, right? He's a nurse.
He's an intern.
It happens to be in the hospital where Icarus was brought because he was injured by a deviant. They have a moment. Mark Curry begins to start to remember who he is.
But he's skeptical.
He is skeptical, which is fine, but he just is so skeptical for so long. So he ends up hooking up with Circe, who's partiesbycirce.com.
There's some references. They've really dated themselves a little bit on some of this.
It's fine. It's of its time.
Yeah.
So Circe, who's living with Thea, is going to be creating a party.
She's not living with Thea.
They're not living? I thought they were living together.
No.
No.
She has a friend, Oldie, or something.
Right? Oh, that's right. You're right.
Yeah. But they're not living together either because at some point, well, that was confusing because at some point Circe is asking for help with rent money. Because she's about to be homeless to her friend. But then later on, it's like they're living in the same apartment.
Right. I guess that's what confused me. Regardless, Circe. Because
Athena's married with a child, a human child.
She is. The details just stick with you as you read this. So anyway, Circe is a party planner and she is creating a party for some diplomats. And there's a convoluted plot of
Vorishiken or Vorishiken.
I'm glad you said that, not me, because I didn't know how to pronounce it.
Stand in Eastern European country of some ill repute.
Some former Soviet bloc. There's a convoluted plot of where they're going to fake take everyone hostage for reasons.
Scientists particularly.
So they can steal some scientists. It's not important. All you need to know is that some terrorists take the party hostage. And this sparks Mark Curry to get his powers back. There's a fun scene where he's running so fast. And then he runs and grabs everybody's guns and he's trying to do it nicely, but he probably broke a few fingers along the way. You know, all that's very clever. It's not something we haven't seen in a Flash comic before, but
important to note during this, like this party so Circe is hosting this party. She was asked to host this party by Druig, who is he's not in charge of this European bloc country yet, but has interest in being the dictator of said country. But Athena is there because she's working for Tony Stark as a scientist. So she's at the party. Makari's there because he met Circe for coffee, or they ran into each other getting coffee and were like, hey, we have a connection. And so Circe's immediately like, hey, we've met for coffee for 15 minutes. Can you come to this party to be my boyfriend there?
I do get that yes, they don't know each other, but they do know each other. So they're drawn.
They had a meet cute.
Yes. But, you know, it's kind of like they're subconsciously drawn to one another, even if they right. don't know why.
This is yeah. how we get all the people in the room.
Exactly. So all the, you know, the top tier Eternals all get in the same room, except, of course, Icarus, who has been currently being tortured by deviants in disguise.
And the deviants are right. And they're it's actually there's a bit of a humorous bit about them trying to figure out how to kill him.
Yes. Actually, this is where Neil Gaiman, his writing kind of shines.
Right.
If it had been more like this, and I know it's morbid, but mm-hmm. if there had been scenes like this of them trying to figure out how to kill him and what they've done in the past, and it's not never really worked.
Right. And they're like discussing the various types of acids they can use. And then at some point they're like, well, nuclear,
exactly.
It's kind of fun. It is that bit is kind of funny.
And this is where Gaiman's trying really hard to make this work. Eventually Icarus does get vaporized. And the little trick of the Eternals is that they're immortal. So their body is reconstructed.
Right.
No, but the Earth is actually a massive computer, kind of.
Right. Well, that's part of the, what's it called? It's not the Unimind is later.
The Unimind is when all the Eternals can kind of connect themselves mentally to create the Unimind. Yeah, so Icarus is actually reconstructed and comes back. He's actually back to being his original self. He's fully right. an Eternal again.
This is in Olympia, not Olympus.
Well, you know. Things get passed down. It's like Game of Telephone.
I love that show, Game of Telephone. Also starring Cersei.
That's right. Icarus is back to being fully formed. Makari now has suspicions, since he's run really fast, that he might be a superhero. So he, of course, goes and finds Sprite.
It's an amazingly slow
yes.
awakening for someone who moves so quickly.
That's brilliant. So he eventually goes and finds Sprite, who is a teenage superstar. Sprite is, of course, the Eternal who is eternally 11 years old.
And therein lies the crux of the whole plot.
Exactly.
But we'll get to that.
We'll get to that. There are good ideas here. Like I said, Kirby had ideas. And the fact that a character is 11 years old for a millennia or more, it's a pretty good idea.
It is.
It's an idea that has been explored in other comics to a greater effect.
Well, and in literature and myth and
yeah, but here I think it's done fairly well as far as okay. So let's just get to it.
Well, there's a bit where Sprite is also claims that he's the influence for Peter Pan.
There is one thing I did like about that, because there are actually a couple superheroes at this party who refuse to do anything because they're on a reality TV show and they signed a contract that they right. can only
they're,
do their
they're
stuff.
They're not allowed to actually do superheroics.
That's an interesting concept.
There's that, you know, I mean, it's, again, it comic kind of roots itself in the time because it is about reality TV shows and reality TV competitions.
Right.
And Sprite is also a social influencer, or that phrase, I think, really existed, but he's the kind of a nascent social influencer.
So that's, you know, fairly topical, I guess. All right, let's just cut to the chase. Eventually, it's found out that Sprite is the cause of this whole thing. Sprite has decided or just was tired of being 11 years old and wanted to age and actually die. So he uses the Unimind in combination with a sleeping celestial to basically make everybody human and erase their memories, or the Eternals, I should say, so that he can just be a real boy.
Right. And somehow this is manipulated so he becomes human. And yeah. there's a bunch of mumbo jumbo around that I don't know if it works a whole lot to be like, oh, suddenly I'm going to be a real boy.
Which doesn't make sense, because if everyone else is, and it's implied that everyone, all the other Eternals are now humans. But mm-hmm. if that were the case, then Icarus should be dead, but he's not right. dead. He was able to survive all this torture and reconstitute himself into a full Eternal. Theoretically, Sprite should just become his old self again. Right.
But of course, that doesn't work for the narrative. So a little bit of sleight of hand going on, you know, I mean, all of this basically to say that Sprite is the big bad, which
yes.
of course Sprite is the big bad because Sprite is the trickster. Sprite is Loki. Sprite, is, you know, it's.
Yeah. Yeah. Sprite's Loki. Sprite's Coyote, yeah. you know, Anansi, whoever. And that is, to get back to your Gaiman themes, Gaiman loves his tricksters.
He does love his tricksters.
Yes. So it's found out that Sprite's behind it all, and all he wants to do is grow old and die.
Just wants to be a real boy.
Yeah, as far as motivation, evil motivation, pretty good.
It's not the most evil motivation, particularly, you know, and he talks about, you know, I think at some point he talks about Cersei sleeping with every single, you know, straight Eternal. Well,
not only that, but all the Eternals have at some point over the millennia slept with each other, except for Sprite.
They've been jumping for, you know, millions of years. It's not the worst motivation in the world.
No. It's kind of creepy, though. I mean, he's bemoaning the fact that he can't sleep with anybody.
Well, but, you know. Imagine going a million years, Paul.
Hey, I'm on my way. Anyway. All right, walk me through this.
Well, let's see if I can. Things get a little cloudy.
So Sprite has done all this. It's a done deal. Everyone's lost their memory. He's a real boy. But then he tricks Makari into getting into the subterranean thing where the sleeping celestial is.
Dreaming Celestial is in Golden Gate Park, because where else would you go?
Of course.
Although kudos for it being in San Francisco and not New York.
Yes,
this is Marvel. Things rarely occur outside of New York City.
But why would he do that? Why would he try to awaken the sleeper if he's already achieved his goal? Doesn't that seem...
And by awaking the Dreaming Celestial will then judge the Earth. And then he's 11 for good.
So why would... That's where it kind of... This story kind of lost me. I said, well, why would he do this?
Motivations are odd here. I don't have an answer for you.
I thought maybe I was missing something.
Nope. Well, I mean, perhaps we are both missing something. There's a lot of dialogue that I read carefully on the first reading and skimmed on the second reading and ignored on the third reading.
And how exactly did Makari become an Eternal again? Because at some point in Golden Gate Park, he has to touch a black rock in order to activate the elevator that takes you down into the blah, 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 blah. But Sprite can't do it because he's a real boy. But it also says that Makari was a real man. But now he's not.
What caused them to awaken in the first place?
Was it because I thought at first it was because the deviants were manipulating things. But it turns out that they're not really.
And the deviants had no good reason to want the Eternals to awaken. So what caused Icarus to start awakening in the first place, and then others started awakening as well? I didn't see a through line here that suggested why this actually started happening. Maybe I missed it. Maybe it's not careful reading.
No, I read this several times too. You can kind of say that the reason Bright is doing all this and waking the Dreaming Celestial was to boast. Mm-hmm. He wanted someone to see how clever, because he says that every time. Look how smart I am. Look how clever I am. Right. So is it just like this? That's his inherent flaw, where he has to be able to brag about his achievements, but in doing so is going to ruin those achievements. It's kind of, you have to take some leaps in logic in order to get to a certain point. And I don't know, those leaps in logic don't always work. So let's just skip to the end, shall we? So eventually, pretty much all the Eternals, the main core of Eternals, have figured out who they are, and they're all gathering on Golden Gate Park to stop the sleeping, dreaming celestial from awakening. We can't have this happen. It's a horrible thing.
To be clear, the awakened Eternals right now are Zoras, Ajak, Thena, Druig, Icarus, Icarus, and Makari, and Cersei.
So they all converge on this thing to stop it from awakening. And then, of course, some Avengers show up, Yellowjacket, Wasp, and Iron Man, to try to help out. Iron Man is quickly dispatched of. Yellowjacket, which is actually one of my favorite parts.
Gets mind controlled.
So he tries to intervene. And he's just dispatched by someone saying, go stand over there and do nothing. Which he does, and then realizes, wait, am I being mind controlled? And I love the fact that, you know, Yellowjacket's just useless. So they can't let this thing awaken until it awakes.
And it's going to awaken at dawn.
And this is a several different anticlimactic moments.
Yeah.
We can't let it awaken. It awakens. Nothing happens. We go back to Olympia, the Eternals base. Zoras tells Thena that she can't have a mortal boy staying here. And she says, yes, we can. Okay. That's right. Anticlimactic.
So before this, so the Celestial does awaken. Then it has a conversation with Makari.
Yes, because he's some kind of chosen one, apparently.
Right, but it's not Ajak who is the one who talks to Celestials. It's Makari, the Celestial. Then the Celestial says that it likes Iron Man.
Which, why?
Right.
I guess because he's an Iron Man and he likes the suit.
Right, well, maybe, sort of. Yeah. You know, the Celestial says that, tells Makari that it's going to just monitor the Earth and humanity for a period of time before deciding whether to destroy the Earth or not. It's going to judge. Everybody's like, okay, cool, cool. Sounds good. All right. Do your thing, bro.
Yeah.
And then Iron Man tries to get the Eternals to register, to do the superhero registration again.
And they, Zerus, of course, say like, no.
Zerus is like, nah, man, come on. You know, we're gods.
Yeah, we've been around for millennia. You've been around for what, a decade? No, we're not doing this.
Right. And so then that ends, and then we get to the final issue, which is where the Celestial is just he's a tourist attraction. It is just standing around. I don't think they have gender.
Yeah, they are standing around.
Yeah, they are standing around, and then tourists are coming up and, you know, contemplating whether they can get gold off of it and, you know, whatever. And this is where, you know, the Deviants show up.
Yeah, the Deviants show up to try to storm Olympia, which is going to be this massive battle, and Druig just wants to kill as many as they possibly can, but Makari steps up, defeats them with humility.
Defeats them with humility, and he's going to be something called a Skadrak. And then the leader of the Deviants says, I can't kill you because if I kill you, he's like, that would not be a victory, because the victory will be when you destroy yourself, because you are this thing that has not been introduced until this very moment. We have no idea what it is. And so then the Deviants just are like, okay, see you guys later. And they just walk away.
Again, anticlimactic moment number three. And then it just ends. Now, I understand that this was a setup for an ongoing series, which did start right after this.
Right.
So this was the pilot episode, essentially. But I get it. Gaiman's setting up ideas that will be picked up in the ongoing series. But a little bit of a clue would have been nice.
Yeah, and then it kind of ends. So it's basically Makari just kind of stands around for a couple weeks meditating on what has happened. Thena has her conversation with Zaras about keeping the child. Ajak just goes back to being a leaf blower, only now he's just hanging around the Celestial, keeping his eye out on it and blowing leaves. Druid goes back to his country to become a dictator. And Makari and Icarus are tasked with finding the rest of the Eternals.
Exactly. And they fly off to do that. There is one moment, though, that I actually think was quite dramatic and well done. And it was very sad, I thought. Zoras goes and finds Sprite.
Bright has escaped during all of this after everybody finds out that he's the one that did all this.
And Zoras, they have a little moment together, and Zoras snaps his neck and closes his eyes very gently and leaves him on a bus.
It's actually, that's one of the more interesting scenes, right? Because Sprite is like, he basically says, I'm not sorry.
This is the most Gaiman of Gaiman-ness in this.
Mm-hmm.
You could easily see this happening in Sandman, and you actually did.
Right.
With Orpheus and that's whole storyline. But that aside, I mean, yes, you were right. Gaiman does have his themes and he likes his motifs.
But it's an interesting conversation that Sprite and Zoras have. It's one of those moments where I find Sprite to actually be, you know, joking aside, I'm a real boy, is actually one of the most sympathetic characters, along with, frankly, the Deviants. We don't have to talk about that necessarily.
Just the whole problematic attitude
larger,
of the...
That's a larger part of the Eternals mythos that isn't directly discussed in this comic, but it's, you know, he didn't want to be 11 years old forever, and that he's like, I know I did all this, but I'm not sorry. You know, when he figures out, he's like, are we going back to Olympia? And Zaras is like, no, we're not. And that's when Sprite realizes that Zaras is there to end him. That's when he says, I'm not sorry. You know, and of course, as we know now, you know, Sprite's back.
Well, of course, they're Eternals. That doesn't take away from the power of this scene. It's actually really well done. And I like the way it's written. I like the way it's drawn. It's almost like a fatherly embrace that Zaras has before he...
But I think the question remains, though, why did Zaras have to kill him? Was this just capital punishment for doing a bad thing? Was it a preventative measure because Sprite can't be trusted because he's the trickster?
I think yes, All of the above.
But it's interesting, you know, because the Eternals are there to protect all humanity.
That's
and
what they say, yeah.
Right, but Sprite is now human.
Yeah, I don't know.
They don't kill humans, but then Zaraz kills a human. I'm not going to say an 11-year-old boy, because Sprite is not really an 11-year-old boy. It's a jarring scene if you just think of Sprite as an 11-year-old. But
he's actually, you know,
a million years old. Or yes. For 330,000, there's a whole timeline to the Eternals that I had to do research on.
There's a lot of rabbit holes you could jump down with the Eternals. Just their inherent nature. I mean, just who they are and where they came from just causes so many problems. At the end, Icarus and Makari, they jet off to find all the Eternals, and it ends with the phrase, the beginning, not the end.
Yeah. And then I think the series that followed it lasted for about 9 issues or something.
Yeah. I mean,
and they were abandoned for a while, and then they brought them back with various other things. And then obviously Kieran Gillen is writing, because of course, who's going to follow Neil Gaiman?
To be fair, the current run is quite good. I've actually just started reading that in preparation for this episode, and he's doing yeoman's work.
Yeah, trying to make them feel like it's way more compelling. I don't know if anybody's reading it. I would assume so, because I think he brings an audience wherever he goes and whatever he writes.
It remains to be seen whether the Eternals can actually become a popular franchise. Hasn't happened yet. I mean, the original Kirby run of 19 issues is the longest series that the Eternals ever had in its entire history. And they've tried to reboot this multiple times. We'll see with the movie whether there sparks an interest into this.
I would not expect the movie to do that, because there's a lot of, well, I don't want to say evidence. There's a lot of discussion about do the Marvel films and the DC films actually contribute to comic book sales? And there's a lot of sales figures and data that suggest that it doesn't really.
But it does bring them into the public consciousness. Who knew the Guardians of the Galaxy before that movie?
Yeah.
To be fair, not very many people, they might have heard of Iron Man, but they had no clue of what it was all about. Iron Man is now, you know, one of the most popular characters in popular culture.
So I don't know. We'll see. You know,
I don't think that's going to happen with the Eternals. I think the Eternals will just be a blip. If anything, the Black Knight might become more popular.
Yeah.
Since Jon Snow is the Black Knight.
It's still a little fun, but who knows? Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, I don't think this is a really great comic book, and I feel really weird saying that about a Neil Gaiman comic.
Yeah. Well, to be honest, it's not a bad comic. It's like I said, just very, very mediocre. I think it's brought down by its really slow pacing and those leaps in logic that we were talking about. You know, it wants to be something that it's not.
Right.
Which is unfortunate. In the end, it's just sort of okay. There's moments in it, like, you know, there are certain scenes and there's certain jokes that are good. You know, maybe smile. But overall, it's just relentlessly forgettable.
At the end of the day, the writing, though, if not the plotting, the writing at the end of the day is still notches above.
Oh, yeah.
Just the generic prose part of it. And the way the dialogue works, believability or not, it's still better written than most everything else out there.
Neil Gaiman is a pretty good comic book writer. His writing, overall, pretty good. I would recommend this if you want to get an idea of who the Eternals are. It's not a classic by any stretch.
I think I generically recommend it as well. It's weird. It sounds like we're trashing it the whole time, but at the end of the day, is it fun? Yes. Are there some completely goofy things? Yes. Are there some interesting themes that occur throughout it? Again, some of we touched on, some, you know, the idea of therapy, the idea of awakenings, and what is humanity, what is mortality. I think these are all very interesting concepts that Gaiman tries to address, but I think gets bogged down in the curse of the Eternals. the eternal curse of the Eternals.
Exactly. And I just, the themes that are in this book are addressed better by Gaiman in, read Sandman. And if you want to know about, you know, the gods on Earth, read American Gods. He deals with this stuff better in other works. which doesn't make this bad. It just makes it, it's not top tier Gaiman. Yeah. So that's it. Neil Gaiman's Eternals was okay. But next time on an all new edition of the Collective Edition, Brian, your choice. What are we going to do?
Well, it's funny that we were talking about Neil Gaiman, then talking about some of Neil Gaiman's themes, which include death. I would like to recommend a comic that is not a collected edition yet. This is a rare break for us. I am going to recommend something that has not yet been collected. I believe the collection comes out in January, but the series did just end. So I'm recommending something that's brand new.
Off the presses.
Literally hot off the presses. And while we don't have the opportunity of having time spent absorbing this comic, it's certainly one of the most powerful comic books I've read in a long time. So I want to talk about it. I want to talk about it before the collection comes out, even. So this comic book is The Many Deaths of Layla Starr. It is written by Ron V, with art by Felipe Andrade, was put out by Boom. The final issue of the 5-issue series just came out less than a month ago.
At the time of this recording.
I think that this is a very intriguing comic book that I feel like has a lot to say and I think is beautiful to look at and beautiful to read. So I'd like to talk about it.
As would I. I have been reading this as well on your recommendation. I think the second or third issue had come out and you were like, get on this now. which I did. And it is a fascinating thing. Well, first of all, we'll get into this. We'll be actually talking about it. But
right.
Rom V, wow, just one of the best writers out there. Just some of the stuff he's been doing is great.
He's doing amazing work across many publishers and companies. Yeah.
So, I mean, if people, just throwing this out there, if you're not already on his run of Swamp Thing, get on it now.
Yep.
He did a series called These Savage Shores, which is about vampires. Whoa, so good. And really
made him, I think, or really brought him into the forefront.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, I'm looking forward to this because it's good.
Yeah.
And I'd be really interested to see what our take, because
I feel like it's interesting or good enough to break our rule.
Yes, absolutely. So that's it, everybody. Thanks for listening. Please leave a comment on our website, collectiveditionpodcast.com. You can leave comments on individual episodes or hit us up on Twitter. I don't know why I'm saying it like that. And again, yeah, thanks for listening. So till next time, keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy-O production. All materials used on the program are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. If you'd like to give us your feedback, the show can be found online at our website, collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes, or send us an email to comments@collectededitionpodcast.com. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.